our series title lends itself to some bad jokes. And so here's a bad joke for you related to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. If you don't get it, don't worry, I'll explain it, which is a sure sign of a really bad joke. Here it goes. A priest and a physicist walk into a bar and they order a Heisenberg beer. The physicist knows how long the bartender takes, but the priest knows that the beer is near. Ba-dum-tsh. If you don't get it, don't worry. In Heisenberg principle, you can either measure how fast a particle is going, or you can know where that particle is. But you can't know both at the same time. So the more certain you are about the velocity, the less certain you are about the location, and vice versa. Okay, you got it? So here we go again. A priest and a physicist walk into a bar and they order a Heisenberg beer. Now, the physicist knows how long the bartender takes, velocity. But the priest knows that the beer is near, location. Yeah, it's still a bad joke. Moving on. My name is Mark, and I'm the pastor at Sycamore Creek in Potterville. I am thrilled that you are with us today for our online worship service as we conclude this series. Clearly, I'm a nerd.
Nerd!
Right? I'm a nerd. I've always been a nerd. I've never in my life been part of the cool crowd, and that has extended to me being a pastor. I'm honestly not a cool pastor, and we're not trying to be a cool church. We try to be honest and authentic and real and sincere and passionate, but we don't try to be cool, and I don't think our church is cool either. Now, while that's true, we're also not as nerdy as we are and as we have been during this series. I feel the need to give that disclaimer today because this might be the nerdiest message of the whole series, and that's saying something. We're concluding our series today called A Priest and a Physicist Walk into a Bar, and the basic goal of this series has been to show that science and faith, they don't necessarily butt heads, they're not necessarily in conflict, but they can be compatible, they can come together. Now, this has been a really nerdy series, and it's been my chance to shine as a scientist and as a pastor, and we've asked you throughout this series to do some really deep thinking. Guess what? That's going to happen again today. Now, this is important stuff, not just for those of us in the church, but this is important as part of our witness to the world, especially to young people. And more, young people think that faith is stupid and that belief in God is not compatible with science. I think they could not be more wrong, but all too often, churches and pastors have shied away from science and from engaging science. I clearly don't have that problem. And today we are going to be wading again into science and faith with a very heady message. Now, something more simple. When asked about the greatest commandment, Jesus answered with this simple answer. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind and love your neighbor as yourself. With all your mind. I think many followers of Christ struggle the most with our minds and with loving God with all our minds, especially when it comes to deeper thinking. And here's the point that I want to make right off the bat from that verse. We worship God with our thinking. We worship God with our thinking. Thinking is good. We have gathered today to worship, and we are worshiping God with our questions, with our wrestling, with our very thinking. It's a value that we have at Sycamore Creek. We worship God with our thinking. And when we worship God with our thinking, we have an open mind. Yes, we follow Jesus passionately and we use our brains and we have an open mind. Now, when I say that we have an open mind, I mean that we engage and we listen and we interact with different perspectives and ideas. We worship God with our thinking. Yes. So here's a question for you to chat about. Where have you been challenged this past year to worship God with your thinking? Let's discuss. Today, we're going to look at several arguments, several thinking arguments of what I would call a naturalistic worldview. When I say that, I'm talking about the worldview that nature is all that there is. It's the idea that only our physical universe is real. It's the idea that every event in our universe can be explained by other parts of the universe. There are no supernatural powers or explanations with this view. There's no God in the system. It's a system ruled by cause and effect, and for every natural effect, there's a natural cause. Matter is all that there is in this view, and matter acts on matter. Everything about you in the world can be reduced and explained through matter, through chemical reactions, molecules, atoms, subatomic particles. And the naturalistic worldview is often called the scientific worldview. And this is where the problem begins to arise. You see, this worldview is, I'm describing it, it's what gives us the impression that science is opposed to faith, because we equate science with this scientific worldview, which is really a naturalistic worldview. And it's this idea that the universe is a closed system where all that exists is matter. No wonder we view science as opposed to faith. I think we often see conflict because of this misunderstanding. Science is not a worldview. Science is a method. It's a method. You see, science arose in the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, and it's important to note that modern science has its roots in Christianity. Christians, they were convinced that the world was created by a rational God. The world, therefore, has a rational structure to it, and we were made. We were made in the image of this rational God. And that led Christians to explore this rational structure, to better understand our world. And what they discovered is that our world has a mathematical quality to it. If we use those mathematical principles that underlie nature, you can have way more control over nature. You can use nature to your advantage. You can harness it. And this thinking has led to tremendous technological advances over the past several centuries. It's amazing, isn't it? Now, the early scientists, all of whom were Christians, carried out their science as a reflection of their faith in a creator. They hit upon this scientific methodology that said we will never appeal to supernatural explanations. You see, the methods of science assume that for a natural effect, there's a natural cause, but that's the method of science. It doesn't require you to believe that there isn't anything outside of what the scientific method can measure. The early scientists, they didn't come up with this method because they didn't believe in God or angels or the supernatural. They came up with this method because they wanted to relentlessly pursue explanations. And they recognized that when you insert the supernatural into science, you stop looking for natural explanations. The process grinds to a halt. The minute you say, well, God did that, you stop exploring. You will never know if, in fact, there was a natural explanation. Thus, the scientific method will never appeal to a supernatural entity or explanation. The scientific method does not address the supernatural. It doesn't talk about a soul. It doesn't talk about God or angels or demons. And this does not mean that you can't believe in those things. You can. It just means that those things are outside the parameters of the scientific method. Scientific methods are limited to the natural world. So here's the thing about science. Applying scientific method, using our rational minds to discover patterns and order and the mathematically precise underpinnings of the natural world. Tom talked about that last week. It works spectacularly well. The success of science has brought about a certain arrogance in some people, where the method has become a worldview. And no longer do things just lie outside of the method of science. These folks go further and say that if it's outside the domain of science, then it's outside the domain of reality. In this view, science defines reality. You see, therefore, a scientific worldview assumes that whatever is real is able to be analyzed according to science. Whatever is real can be broken down into its smallest parts. And this is reductionism. If you analyze things according to the smallest parts, you can explain everything with scientific methods. I want to argue today that is not science. The statement that everything can fit into a scientific method is not a scientific statement. It's a faith statement. It's metaphysics. You can't know that ahead of time. A science is a method. It shouldn't be a worldview. And if we stick with the methodology of science, well, then there's no conflict between science and faith. Today, we're going to take a closer look at one area of conflict that arises out of the naturalistic worldview. We're going to cover five quick arguments, don't worry, they'll be quick, against this aspect of the naturalistic worldview, which is called determinism. Again, in the naturalistic worldview, every single cause has a single effect. Every single effect has a single cause. And what determinism does is determinism proposes that though we think we make free decisions, mental states are brain states, which are biological states, which are physical states, which are determined states. So determinism argues that our feeling of free will is actually the result of hidden deterministic causes such as belief, desire, temperament, and more. In determinism, every event is caused by a previous event. And given the flow of the universe, things had to be the way they are. Everyone and everything is simply a victim to the dominoes that fell before them. One domino leads to another domino leads to another. Determinists argue that just because we can't pinpoint the exact factors that led us to an action, we could still, in theory, isolate them if we knew enough about all the beliefs, desires, and temperaments swirling around in our brains. Thus, even the most atrocious actions, they couldn't have been otherwise. And then the conviction that people should be held responsible would therefore be a complete illusion. In determinism, you can't really make a free choice. Now, this all flows from a naturalistic worldview, and I chafe against it. So if I do this, or if I do this, it was predetermined that I would do that millions of years ago by causes and effects that led to my beliefs, to my desires, and my temperament that I would do those things. There's nothing I can do about it. It's predetermined. The belief in determinism produces a conflict with faith in God. In determinism, there's no moral responsibility. You can't help the things you do. And if there's no moral responsibility, then there's no sin. And if there's no sin, then the whole problem that God addresses throughout the Bible and it definitively addresses through Jesus, well, it's not really a problem at all. If sin isn't a problem, you don't need a Savior. You don't need Jesus. And the whole Christianity thing falls apart. So here's the question. Does science require us to accept that determinism is true? I'm going to give you a moment to chat. Do you think we really have free will, or is everything predetermined? Let's chat. So I have to be honest with you. I don't think determinism is true. And therefore, I think we have free will. And today, I want to give you five brief arguments against a deterministic worldview, against this naturalistic worldview. Hey, here's the first argument, that determinism confuses method with worldview. Now, as I've already talked about, though scientific methodology is great, it's great for answering natural questions, it becomes very restricting when it is assumed to be reality. See, science can only deal with what science can deal with. It becomes problematic, though, when we take our methodology of science and assume that it's how all the world operates. This assumption, it's arrogant. And I'm going to wade back into pets here. I know pets are a sensitive subject. But the assumption of science as a worldview is as arrogant as our pets who, let's be honest, can't understand or even conceive of trigonometry. Assuming that the only things he or she can understand and conceive of are real. That's crazy, right? To assume that human scientific inquiry is the only approach to knowledge, it ignores the finitude of our brains. As I said earlier in this series, what is to humans like trigonometry is to dogs? Although our brains are more evolved than a dog's, we're still limited. We don't know what we don't know. Now, turning the scientific method into a scientific worldview is like turning a dog method into a dog worldview. Imagine your pet saying, the only things that are real are the things that a dog can process and assess and analyze. Therefore, trigonometry doesn't exist. If I can't conceive of it, it doesn't exist. That sounds stupid, right? The gap between our understanding and God's understanding is far bigger than between us and a dog. Compared to God, we have incredibly limited understanding. So we need to have humility. There have to be things in our world that we can't conceive of. I know there are things like beauty and love and hope and faith that can't be subjected to the scientific method. If we stick to the method, everything is fine, but making it a worldview, it brings big problems. And that brings us to argument number two, that Jesus refutes determinism. Now, Jesus never said, "Here, let me refute determinism." But he said a lot of things that are inconsistent with determinism. He held people accountable. He talked about choices. He treated people like they were responsible for their actions. And he said in a prophecy about Jerusalem, "O Jerusalem, O Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it, how often have I desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings? But you were not willing." Jesus warns of a coming judgment on Jerusalem. God doesn't want it to come. God doesn't love judgment. And in fact, God's heart breaks for the people of Jerusalem. God's desire is to gather children like a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you are not willing. Now, Jesus assumes that people could have chosen otherwise. Jesus does not propose determinism. He says we have real choices. And we find this throughout the Gospels. Luke says about the Pharisees, "But by refusing to be baptized by him," that's John the Baptist, "the Pharisees and the lawyers rejected God's purpose for themselves." They rejected God's purpose for themselves. People have the choice to say no thank you, friend, to God. We can reject God's purpose for our lives. And Luke tells us that the Pharisees, by not being baptized, rejected God's purpose for themselves. And that brings us to our third argument, that consciousness refutes determinism. I got to be honest, this is the toughest argument to get your head wrapped around, but it's a really cool argument too, so I hope you get it. On some level, you are aware that you are a person who makes free decisions and that you could choose one thing or another thing and that you're morally responsible. We just know this. We're aware of it. It's a fundamental human experience, a fundamental reality to who we are. And to dismiss it and say it's just an illusion, that's insufficient. So here's the question. How does matter become self-aware? You are aware right now that you exist, right? If you're aware of it, will you type "I exist" in the comments just to let me know you're listening? We are self-aware, but we don't understand how that works. Determinists will argue that our self-awareness is an epiphenomenon. They'll argue that it's an illusion. But that's a big problem because our self-awareness is the only reality we know. It's the one fundamental slice of reality which we have firsthand access to. You don't need to be a scientist to know that you exist. It's a fact. You're self-aware. This can't be an illusion. And if this isn't real, then nothing is real. Our self-awareness is the standard. Now, in addition, to be self-aware is to be aware that we are free will agents, that we make decisions. You're making a decision right now to listen to me or to tune me out or think, what is he talking about? We act and we live based on the assumption that our decisions are actual, real decisions. If self-awareness is fundamental, then so is free will. So is free will. Why would nature produce beings who have to act in a way that's in conflict with reality? It doesn't make sense. We have to act as though we are conscious and free. If the deterministic worldview is correct, then our self-awareness is an epiphenomenon. It's illusion, and we're thoroughly deceived by our own brains. And if we can't trust our own self-awareness, then we should doubt all of our brain's processes, including our brain's logical reasoning processes. Determinism forces us to regard that's what is fundamental to our experience as a deception. If we can't trust our brain's own self-awareness, then we have no basis to trust our brains at all. Which leads to our fourth argument. And the fourth argument is that determinism undermines reason. It undermines reason. This is self-refuting because we have to use reason to get to determinism. A physicist in the last century, Jay Haldane, he's just got an amazing mustache, he said this, If my mental processes are determined wholly by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true. And hence, I have no reason for supposing my brain to be composed of atoms. Interesting. And what that is that's a circular argument. Now, according to the naturalistic worldview, there are three premises and a conclusion in this argument. The first premise is that everything is a chemical reaction. Everything is a chemical reaction. And from that everything is a natural chemical reaction, it leads to a second conclusion that chemical reactions themselves have no truth value. You can't argue with a chemical reaction. They're just events. You burped. You farted. It's just a chemical reaction. You wouldn't say about someone's flatulence, was that true? You wouldn't say about it, I disagree. That was argumentative flatulence. You can't argue with a sneeze or with a sound or with a thunderclap. They're chemical reactions. So a naturalistic worldview argues that everything is a chemical reaction, that chemical reactions have no truth value, and then third, that my thinking right now, it's a chemical reaction. And if my thinking right now is a complex version of my flatulence, well, then that leads to this conclusion. My thinking right now has no truth value. This is funky stuff. If that conclusion is true, then it's false. The falseness of the conclusion is presupposed to argue for its truth. It's a self-refuting statement. It can't be true that my thinking right now has no truth value. We have to assume that our thinking has truth value to get to the conclusion. If my thoughts that I'm sharing via speaking right now are just burps, if they're just chemical reactions, then why are you listening to me? You assume that there is some truth, there's some value to what I am saying today, and that the words make some sort of sense. This means that our thoughts must have truth value, that what I'm saying today matters, and that we must be more than just chemicals popping. That leads us to our fifth argument, chance and purpose. This is the easiest one to get our heads wrapped around, and hopefully it's the most memorable. Hey, you get to choose. You get to choose whether things happen by chance or by purpose, by some sort of design. Your perspective matters. And now let's say that Gordon and Carol from the Potterville campus are returning from Florida. Each year, they go to Florida, and I miss them, and I'm also a little jealous, too, when they head down to Florida. Now imagine that on driving back into Michigan from being out of state, Gordon and Carol notice a rock formation that's at the border of Michigan that's patterned to spell, "Welcome to Michigan." And Carol says, "Oh, look, we must be entering Michigan." But Gordon replies, "Carol, don't you know that thousands of years ago, glaciers receded across this continent and they randomly dropped boulders as they left? Those aren't there by design. They're just here by random chance. So we don't know if we are in Michigan or not." Now, here's the thing we must remember. The higher the level of order there is, the less it makes sense to appeal to chance. Now, it makes sense for Carol to trust the rocks to tell her that they are entering Michigan because she believes in a mind behind those rocks that put them into that order. It also makes sense for Gordon to appeal to chance, however unlikely that chance might be. Now, what would not make any sense would be for Gordon to say that the rocks are here by chance and that they are trustworthy to communicate the entrance to Michigan. That doesn't make sense. You see, for the rocks to communicate something, they need to be purposeful. In the same way, we have a bunch of chemical reactions that are going on in our brain right now. You are listening, and there are things that are happening in your brain. Now, either they are just chemical poppings that are there by chance, or they're a result of a powerful design. Yet we trust those poppings to tell us the truth, meaning that we have to believe that our chemical poppings are designed for the purpose of thinking rational thoughts, which is the opposite of being random. And there has to be a mind that designed these poppings to allow us to think rational thought. Otherwise, how could we trust random chance to communicate truth? We can't. Unless there is a mind at the beginning, how can we develop a mind in the process? You don't get reason by accident. It has to be part of the intent of creation. I would argue that mind is more fundamental than matter. How could randomness self-organize? Randomness doesn't produce reason. The reason is at the structure of all things, or it's not here at all. So let's wrap this up today. Science is an incredibly powerful method, and its predictive capacity in our world is awesome. The scientific method works because reason works. Now, that can lead to a belief in a higher being, a higher mind, a higher intelligence that is somehow behind everything we experience and everything that we know. In the attempt to turn the scientific method into a naturalistic, deterministic worldview, we can underline the very reasoning process that the scientific method is based on. On the other hand, if there's an intelligent God who created intelligent beings and placed them all in a rational world, then all these issues are explained and reason itself makes sense. So here's your choice. I believe it's a free choice. You are free to choose whether you will live as though there is a God or not. Now, of course, I believe that there is a God that created you, a God that loves you, a God that sacrificed himself for you and for your freedom, for your healing, and your forgiveness. I believe that God is an all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-loving God. And I think that when you use your brain, when you use your mind, and you allow that brain to turn toward God, that you can commit to returning God's love. It's your choice, and you are free to make it. So here's our final question. What choice do you make today? To live out a belief in God or not? Amen.